Imagine a CEO, ringing the opening bell at the stock exchange. They are celebrating a year where their company's revenue absolutely doubled.
Right. The financial press is cheering. The stock is up. The board is just thrilled.
Exactly. But behind closed doors, the cold, hard math shows that every single new dollar they brought in actually made the company worth less.
It's a really jarring thought. It completely contradicts the basic narrative of modern business.
Yeah, we're conditioned to believe that corporate growth is inherently good. It's the ultimate metric of success, right? But what if that assumption is entirely backward? What if most growth under the surface is actually just an engine for wealth destruction?
We just assume that a company getting larger is, a company getting more valuable. But when you strip away the marketing and look at the underlying mechanics of capital, you realize that growth is essentially just setting money on fire.
Unless you have very specific structural conditions in place.
Right, exactly.
And that's exactly the paradox we're untangling today. In this deep dive, we're exploring core concepts from The Infinite Investor, which is part of the broader Averaging Up collection.
Yeah, and we are looking at the market through the eyes of two absolute titans of investing theory.
Bruce Greenwald of Columbia University, widely considered the dean of competitive strategy.
And Aswath Damodaran of NYU, the dean of valuation.
What makes this pairing so fascinating is that they approach the market from entirely opposite ends of the analytical spectrum.
Yeah, Greenwald is obsessed with structure. He's looking at the physical layout of the competitive battlefield, while Damodaran is obsessed with the numbers, the cold, hard cash flows.
Yet they arrive at the exact same inescapable verdict about when growth actually matters and when it just destroys a company.
Which is pretty rare in finance, honestly.
Wait, so you're telling me growth can actually make a company worth less? That sort of breaks my brain a little. How is that physically possible? I mean, if I'm selling more widgets today than I did yesterday, how am I destroying value?
Well, let's use an analogy. Think of a gold rush.
Okay, imagine an open field where someone discovers a massive vein of gold. Now, if there are no fences, no barriers to entry, anyone can easily buy a shovel and start digging in the exact same spot.
Because high returns act like a beacon.
Exactly. So as more people arrive, the gold gets divided into smaller and smaller shares. At the same time, the sudden demand for shovels and picks drives the cost of equipment through the roof.
Oh, wow. So you're paying more just to dig.
Right. Eventually, the sheer cost and effort of digging is barely worth the fraction of gold you're pulling out of the ground.
Okay, so the effort goes way up, but the reward gets squeezed to basically zero.
Yes. This is the mechanism of capital compression. If a business discovers a highly profitable market but has no structural barrier to protect it, competitors will ruthlessly follow the growth.
They deploy their own capital, chase your exact same customers, and just compete on price.
Exactly. They spend massive amounts on marketing just to steal your market share. Hmm. And in doing so, they drive the returns of that business all the way back down to the bare minimum required to just stay alive. So the company is fundamentally larger. It has more employees, more factories. Its revenue line is soaring. But the actual economic value of all that expansion is completely neutralized by the cost of competing.
That's Greenwald's brutal thesis. In a nutshell, growth outside a moat creates zero value.
The intrinsic value of the enterprise stays completely flat, or even shrinks, while the revenue goes up.
Right. For growth to actually compound your wealth, it must happen inside a barrier to entry. We're talking about things like regulatory licenses, which legally prevent a competitor from setting up shop next door.
Or powerful network effects, where the product becomes more valuable as more people use it.
Exactly. Or captive demand, driven by incredibly high switching costs. Without those structural walls, Greenwald argues that growth is just an expensive illusion.
I feel like we saw this exact dynamic play out with the whole ride-sharing boom.
Oh, absolutely.
You had Uber and Lyft growing at astronomical rates, taking over cities, booking billions in revenue. But because the barrier to entry was practically zero, I mean, drivers and riders could just have both apps on their phones and pick whichever was cheaper that day. They had to heavily subsidize rides to compete.
That's a perfect modern example. Ride-sharing companies grew their top-line revenue at historical rates, but for a very long time, they were destroying billions in shareholder value to do it.
Because the growth was happening in an open field.
Right, so the capital was compressed.
Okay, so Greenwald shows us how to build the walls and keep the competitors out. But let's say my walls are up. I have a monopoly, or at least a very strong moat. Does that automatically mean I'm printing money? Or is there, like, a hidden catch to maintaining that fortress?
That is exactly where we bring in Aswath Damodaran. If Greenwald builds the walls, Damodaran counts the treasure.
And he's the numbers guy.
Exactly. Damodaran doesn't care about your strategy narrative. He cares about the unforgiving arithmetic of reinvestment. His absolute rule is that growth is never free. It always requires capital.
Right. You have to build a new factory, yes. Hire the new sales team, acquire the new servers.
Yes. It takes money to make money. But value is only added if the return on invested capital, the ROIC, exceeds the cost of capital.
Let's pause there, because cost of capital is one of those terms that gets thrown around in finance all the time, but it can sound a bit opaque. Break that down for us.
Let's strip it down. Think of the cost of capital like the interest rate on a business loan. Let's say you borrow money at 8% from the bank to buy a lemonade stand.
Okay, 8% interest.
Right. You pour all your energy into it, and the stand generates a 6% profit on the money you invested. You are bleeding 2% every single day.
Ouch. So you aren't growing, you're sinking.
Exactly. It doesn't matter if you open 10 more lemonade stands across the city and your revenue skyrockets. Growing that business faster just means you are destroying your value at a higher velocity.
So if a company is bragging about 50% revenue growth, but their return on capital is lower than what it costs them to fund that growth, they're essentially just running faster and faster on a treadmill.
Yes. The arithmetic does not care about your narrative. It doesn't matter how revolutionary your product is or how many users you're acquiring.
If the math doesn't clear the cost, you're destroying value.
Exactly.
But hold on, I want to push back on this because history has some pretty glaring exceptions. Didn't Amazon lose money for over a decade just acquiring users, building out warehouses, and, you know, building Amazon Web Services?
Oh, he did, yeah.
Through Damodaran's lens, they looked like they were destroying value with massive capital reinvestment, but they were actually building a multi-trillion dollar empire.
Yeah.
Why isn't every new disruptive tech company just going through that exact same necessary phase?
That is the critical nuance, and it's why you have to look at both Greenwald and Damodaran together. Amazon was bleeding cash, yes,
yeah,
but they were spending that capital to build an impenetrable structural moat.
The massive economies of scale.
Exactly, and an unparalleled logistical network. They were driving down their future cost of delivery to a point where no competitor could ever match them. Once the moat was built, the return on invested capital skyrocketed well above the cost of capital. But most companies aren't doing that. Most companies are just bleeding cash to buy users who will leave the second a cheaper alternative comes along.
So Amazon was building the fortress walls with that money. Most companies are just buying shovels in an open field.
That's a great way to put it. When you put these two philosophies side by side, you realize they aren't competing theories. They are the exact same truth viewed from different angles.
They're describing cause and effect.
Right. The structural moat that Greenwald demands is the actual reason the return exceeds the cost that Damodaran measures. Without Greenwald's barrier, competition compresses the return down below the cost of capital.
The infinite investor has a really brilliant way of visualizing this. It says to imagine the return on growth as a dial, and the structural moat is the hand that physically holds that dial up above the cost of capital.
That's a perfect visual. Structure determines the duration of your advantage, how long you can keep the competitors out, and the arithmetic determines its magnitude, how much actual cash that advantage generates.
And if you're listening to this and wondering how this applies to you, whether you're trying to figure out where to put your 401k, where you're running a local small business, like a marketing agency or a landscaping company, this exact same filter applies.
It absolutely does. If you decide to expand your business into a new city, but you have no unique advantage there, you aren't really growing. You are just volunteering for a treadmill.
So let's put this framework to the ultimate test. A theory is only as good as its real-world application. Let's apply the two Dean's test to the largest growth wager in business history right now, artificial intelligence.
Oh, this is where it gets really interesting.
Hundreds of billions of dollars are being poured into AI. Everyone is promising exponential growth. Let's break it down through both lenses, starting with Greenwald's structural filter. Where is the moat in AI?
Through Greenwald's lens, the barrier is highly questionable right now. I mean, you have dozens of extremely well-funded labs training comparable foundation models.
And more importantly, anyone can simply rent access to these models through an API.
Exactly. If an enterprise can switch from one language model to another with a few lines of code and minimal friction, then the growth of these AI companies is happening in an open field.
And as we just established, growth outside a durable moat invites vicious competition, which means the returns get compressed.
Right. We are already seeing incredible pricing pressure on these foundation models because the core capability is essentially becoming commoditized.
Precisely. Now let's shift to Damodaran's arithmetic filter, the cost of delivery. This is where the math of AI gets incredibly challenging.
Yeah, because AI scales with linear unit costs. Every single time you ask an AI to generate an image or synthesize a 100-page document or write code, it requires heavy physical costs in server power, data processing, and electricity.
Let's clarify that distinction because the infinite investor uses a great comparison here. The Netflix model versus the Spotify model. What do we mean by linear unit costs versus fixed costs?
Think about Netflix. When Netflix spends $30 million to produce an episode of a hit show, that cost is fixed.
Right, it's already spent.
Exactly. Whether one person streams that episode or 100 million people stream it, the production cost doesn't change. That is massive fixed cost leverage. As they add more subscribers, their profit margins widen beautifully because the cost to serve the next user is basically zero.
But Spotify operates under entirely different arithmetic.
Right. Every single time a user streams a song on Spotify, Spotify has to pay a royalty fraction to the record label. The cost scales linearly with the usage.
The more you consume, the more Spotify pays.
And Damodaran points out that generative AI is currently functioning much more like Spotify. The compute costs rise in lockstep with the revenue.
Because it's not just a file sitting on a server waiting to be downloaded. The AI actually has to think, it has to run the calculation live, burning electricity and compute power every single time I type a prompt.
Exactly. Which means the profit margins never naturally widen the way we've come to expect in traditional software businesses. And this sets a hard ceiling on the value proposition of the technology itself.
Interesting.
Damodaran laid out a very specific mathematical reality. Let's say a consulting firm wants to automate a team of analysts. If it costs $600,000 in AI compute and data infrastructure to replace a consultant, then the AI only makes financial sense if it replaces consultants who are paid more than $600,000.
Wow. So the sheer physical cost of the growth strictly limits how far the disruption can actually reach into the economy. It creates a literal cost floor.
It does. But there is another element to this AI wager that Damodaran observed, which might be the most fascinating part of the entire equation.
The circular economy of AI capital.
Yes. It's the illusion of demand masking the reality of the math.
I was hoping we would get to this because when you look at the quarterly earnings of the big cloud providers, the revenue numbers look absolutely staggering. They are reporting billions in AI demand. How is that an illusion? Let's trace how this money actually moves.
Let's trace a single dollar. A major cloud provider, let's say Microsoft, just as a hypothetical example, invests $1 billion into a hot new AI startup.
Okay, the startup celebrates. They look incredibly well-funded, and their valuation skyrockets.
But there's a catch. That startup needs massive computing power to train its models. So where do they go to buy that compute? They go right back and rent server space from Microsoft Azure.
Wow. So Microsoft hands them $1 billion in venture capital, and the startup essentially hands it right back as cloud revenue.
Exactly. It looks like booming customer demand on the income statement, but it's just the same dollar doing a lap around the building.
Capital flowing in a circle is not the same thing as intrinsic value being created.
No, it generates the appearance of explosive growth, but it entirely sidesteps the fundamental question, is there genuine end-user demand out in the real world willing to pay a price that clears the massive cost of the compute?
Right now, much of the revenue we are seeing is just investment capital masquerading as customer demand.
Exactly.
Okay, I have to jump in here and make sure we aren't throwing the baby out with the bathwater. By applying these strict filters, neither Dean is claiming that AI is a technological failure. Right? I mean, the capability of these models is obviously revolutionary.
That is a vital distinction, and I'm really glad you brought it up. They are not questioning the technology for a second. What they are questioning is the financial return on the growth of the technology.
Because a great technology isn't always a great business.
Right. The history of innovation is littered with technologies that completely changed the world, but absolutely bankrupted the companies that built them.
Like the airlines.
Exactly like the airlines, or the early automobile industry. I mean, airlines revolutionized human existence. They shrank the globe.
But for decades, they were terrible investments.
Because they required massive, continuous capital reinvestment, buying new planes, maintaining hubs, and they lacked any real structural barriers to entry. Anybody with enough capital could lease a plane and fly the same route.
So until AI growth is proven to be protected by a moat and profitable above its astronomical cost of capital, it remains, as the infinite investor so perfectly puts it, a story in search of a number.
Exactly.
Okay, if AI currently represents the danger zone of unprotected, high-cost growth, what does the ultimate ideal look like? Let's move to the one business architecture where both of these titans, Greenwald and Damodaran, fall completely silent.
The architecture that effortlessly meets both the structural condition and the numerical condition.
In the Averaging Up collection, this is referred to as the Free Surfer.
Yes. The Free Surfer is basically the holy grail of business models. It is an architecture where growth requires almost no effort and no capital. Let's run it through our two filters to see why it's so powerful.
Okay, start with Greenwald.
First, Greenwald is satisfied because the growth happens entirely inside an impenetrable moat. Think of Visa's payment network or the massive passive index funds like Vanguard.
Let's break down Visa. Why is that a free surfer?
Think about the global shift from cash to digital payments. It's a macroeconomic wave. But that volume flows through Visa's established network, not around it.
Because it is impossibly difficult for a new competitor to convince tens of millions of merchants and billions of consumers to adopt a brand new payment terminal simultaneously.
Right, the network effect is an absolute barrier. Visa captures the wave without having to fight for it.
And crucially, Damodaran is satisfied because of the near zero marginal cost.
Exactly. Let's look at the unit economics of a single swipe of a Visa card. The network is already built, the servers are already running.
When you go buy a coffee and swipe your card, the wave of new growth arrives at almost zero additional cost to Visa.
Right. Contrast that with a traditional bank that has to literally build a new brick-and-mortar branch and hire tellers to get more deposits.
Or contrast it with the Spotify or AI curse we just talked about. It's not a heavy physical cost that scales linearly with every single unit.
Exactly. When Visa processes an extra million transactions or an investor drops another $1,000 into an S&P 500 index fund, the company doesn't have to build a new factory. They just let the volume flow through the existing infrastructure.
And that is where the magic of true value creation happens. The return on that incremental growth doesn't just clear the cost of capital. The profit margin actually widens as it scales.
The return profile just goes vertical. The Free Surfer represents the rare anomaly where growth is structurally protected from competition and mathematically exempt from heavy reinvestment.
It is the one place where the dean of strategy and the dean of valuation have absolutely nothing left to warn you against.
It's the perfect business.
So let's distill all of this down to the final filter. The ultimate takeaway for you, the listener, as you analyze your own career, your business, or any compelling market narrative you see on the news.
Growth is not a virtue in and of itself.
Exactly. Growth is merely a multiplier. If it is protected by a structural moat and clearing its cost of capital, it is a multiplier of value. Everywhere else, in every other scenario, it is a destroyer of value.
It really forces a complete recalibration of how you look at success. The next time you see a headline celebrating a company's massive top-line expansion or user acquisition, your immediate instinct shouldn't be to applaud.
Your instinct should be to ask, is this a structural fortress, or is this just an incredibly fast, incredibly expensive treadmill?
Exactly.
Which leaves us with a lingering, provocative thought for you to explore on your own. Look at the broader economic landscape right now, or even look closely at the specific industry you work in.
Think about the companies that are currently dominating the headlines, the ones raising massive rounds of capital and touting exponential growth.
Are the companies you see celebrating true protected compounding? Or are they just running a treadmill, burning through cash, waiting for the day their story finally has to meet its number?
This content is educational and reflects a personal analytical framework. It does not constitute investment advice. Visit averagingup.com.